This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Starting in December of this year, anyone in this country who's paid by salary, not hourly, and makes under $47,476 a year will become eligible for overtime pay. Well, not exactly everyone. There are some exemptions. But that's about double the threshold right now, where only workers who have a salary under $23,500 automatically get overtime pay. That number hasn't been updated in more than a decade, but this is a much bigger leap than previous increases, and it could affect more than 4 million workers across the country. State officials say somewhere between 8.5 and 10,000 workers in Vermont could be in this new category. But as I said, it's not a simple equation of more hours equals more pay. Employers have some ability to change the way they operate, too. And some are saying this could be a big hassle not only for them, but for their workers when it comes to flexibility and even in how much money they make. We're going to unravel the various threads here and talk about how employers and employees are thinking about this news, and we'd love your help with that. If you are affected as either an employer or a worker, you can let us know what you're thinking and how things might change. Is this water cooler conversation? Is this something that you're having board meetings about already? Does this have you scared or excited or both? How's it going to change your business? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And we're joined now by Karen Stackpole. She leads the Employment and Labor Law Group at Paul Frank and Collins Attorneys. Karen Stackpole, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So this new law needed? This new change, this increase?
Great question. So it's a new regulation. So just to kind of go back and remember our civics from, like, you know, fifth grade or seventh, I suppose, these days. This is a new regulation made by the executive branch, in this case, President Obama's Department of Labor. And so this regulation of literally just the overtime exemptions, and that's all it is, has nothing to do with minimum wage because that has to be dealt with by Congress. But is it needed? It's certainly an update. The threshold presently is really, really low for who is an exempt employee and who's not. So and the exemption test is actually a two-part test that a lot of people forget. Number one is a salary test, which this really relates to. The other is the duties test. And the duties test is something that commonly people mess up. So I think it's long overdue that there is perhaps a focus on the exemptions, the white collar exemptions particularly, and to have a significant increase in the very low threshold, in my view, probably does make some sense.
All right. So this threshold increase from going from about 23,500, 23,600 mm-hmm. to 47,500-ish, bumps a lot of people who are in between that up into mm-hmm. being eligible for overtime pay. But you said the duties test is also one that people mess up all the time or don't fully right. understand. So can you explain that one?
Sure. So and this happens, fairly frequently. This law was originally enacted in 1938. So it was part of the New Deal and hasn't had lots of updates. The duties test is really a test that says, does this person perform as their primary duty? Now, before the 2004 change by the Bush administration, that primary duty was an 80-20 test. So 80% of your time had to be spent on doing exempt duties in order to hit the duties test. Now it's the primary duty, which is although it's nonspecific in the regulations that were enacted in 2004, it's basically more often than not, is it the most important thing that you do or not? It's kind of a weight that is given to it. And the primary duties fit into certain of these categories depending on which exemption you're dealing with. So you've got the executive exemption, basically for people who are in management, who have higher fire authority, who regularly manage two or more full-time equivalents.
Meaning if you are an executive, you are exempt from this law. You don't automatically become eligible for overtime pay even if you make under $47,000.
No, that won't be right. So for instance, you have to meet the salary and the duties test. So if I am only being paid $25,000 and I'm doing exempt duties, I don't pass the salary test because I don't have the threshold that will now be in place as of December 1st. So that's why both kind of go together. And the other piece is There's actually, I suppose, a third part. If you talk about the salary test is really about getting paid the same amount of money each week, regardless of the quality or quantity of my production. So no matter how good I am or how bad I am or how much I work or how little I work, I get the same amount each week. And there aren't deductions for, oh, Karen didn't come in Friday afternoon. Oop, take 3 hours off, you know, something like that. So that's the salary test. It's a certain threshold. And now, obviously, that threshold is going up to $9.13 a week, up from $4.55, which is huge. In the 1970s, the amount was, before the change, was about $175, went up to about $250. And so, you know, then it went up from there. So there haven't been changes regularly over the course of time. One of the good things that this new rule does is it has a look-see every 3 years, and it's trying to keep pace essentially with inflation and allowing people to have a growth in their wages to keep that rolling. But like I said, once the salary test is met, you also have to meet the duties test. So there are a lot of people who are paid over the threshold even now doing, let's say, administrative functions. Somebody who, let's say, is a long tenured, even in my business, you know, a legal assistant or somebody who's a paralegal, something like that. And as long as they meet the salary test, that's great, but they still have to meet the duties test. So if somebody doesn't meet the duties test, then they too are not exempt from minimum wage or overtime. So when you think about the terms, a lot of people say, oh, you're a salaried employee. I don't have to pay you overtime. Totally wrong thinking.
Already
wrong thinking. So because the idea is it's exempt versus non-exempt. And the default in this law is everybody gets overtime. That's the default. So you have to, if you want to exempt somebody from that, you have to fit them into one of the categories that involve exemptions. So these are the white collar exemptions that are really being addressed with this rule.
Okay. So how many people in Vermont do you think are likely to actually be affected by these rules?
So there are different numbers that have been bandied about by different organizations. I was interested to hear what you just indicated by the Vermont Department of Labor thinking. Estimate from the Economic Policy Institute is about 25,000 people in Vermont will be impacted. It's not going to be an insubstantial number because the jump is so high.
All right. So you think some statistics say up to 25,000 workers. It sounds like the Department of Labor, and we'll have Commissioner Annie Noonan on to explain how they get their numbers. But they were saying something around 8,500 to 10,000 workers likely to be affected. Either way, it's still quite a significant number of Vermont workers who are likely to be affected by this law.
Absolutely.
So let's talk. We're going to talk about some of them. And if you are among them, I really hope you will call in. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or if you're wondering, am I? Do I meet these exemptions? I don't totally get it, but I think I might be eligible for something. And now do I have to have a conversation with my employer? You can ask Karen Stackpole a question. You know, she's not your lawyer, but she is a lawyer.
There you
so
go.
We will have some information for you. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note. Tell us what you're thinking. Post it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. But Karen, while we wait and see if we get any workers calling in, let's talk a little bit about employers, because
sure,
this is something that employers are going to have to do to make these changes or to figure out what do we do for our company. So what's the first thing employers should be thinking about here? Let's just start there, because there are a lot of different ways that they can go about making changes. But what's sort of the thinking that you think employers should be taking right now?
I think the first thing people should do is use this as an opportunity to audit their own decisions with regard to who's exempt and non-exempt in their organization and take fresh eyes on those and see if, in fact, they are already, you know, on the right track, or if this gives them a great excuse to go, oh, geez, we've been doing this for a while. Let's fix that, which happens. I mean, this law is very employee friendly. As I say, 1938 is when it was put in place. It's also the burden of proof is actually on the employer in this law, which is rare. In things where we think about discrimination cases and wrongful termination cases, burden is on the plaintiff, meaning the employee. For wage and hour law, employers have an obligation to A, track time correctly, for their record-keeping obligation is they have to track time for non-exempt employees correctly. So if I don't currently have a good tracking system for how I am tracking hours of my employees who are non-exempt, I'm going to want to put one of those in play because now there's probably more of those people I'm going to have to track. And so it gives me an opportunity to take a look at that. It gives me also an opportunity to look at efficiencies. And I think that's a really important thing for businesses to think about too. Some people will say, oh, this law is just going to, you know, it's going to bankrupt me. It's going to take me out of business. Maybe, but I doubt it. You know, I think more often than not, it's about looking at your workforce, taking a look at what people are doing, how efficiently they're doing it. You know, it's like water sometimes work. If I say to you, hey, I'm going to pay you this fixed amount, I need you to get the job done. You might be efficient in the 8 hours that you're in my office, but you might take work home and it might take you 10 or 12 hours to perform what could be performed in 8 hours. And that's about management. And a lot of what my practice is about is teaching managers to be focused and looking at not just how much am I spending on these employees, but how well are they working. And efficiency is going to matter. So.
But that is going to make a huge difference then for employees, too, absolutely, who are saying, oh, gosh, you know, if you're telling me I can only do 40 hours, mm-hmm, that's going to change the way I work as an employee as well in thinking about how efficient am I? And yep, what if you're not as efficient a worker, but you're OK with the idea of, you know, I take a little bit of work home so I can get it done, mm-hmm, and I'm a good employee. And is this now going to affect me because my employer might say, no, you better get it done in 8 hours a day or you're not going to have a job?
Yeah, so that's possible. But I think it also I fully appreciate sometimes people look at that as just a negative. Again, I would look at that as a positive in the sense that it gives everybody the opportunity to say, where can we have greater efficiencies? Because one possible result of this may be that employers may say, I can't afford to pay the overtime because that's at time and a half, any hours over 40 that somebody works in a work week. Another misconception. Many employers think it's pay period. It's not. It's work week. Any 168 contiguous hours become a work week. And so,
although different employers structure that differently. It doesn't necessarily have to be a Monday to Friday.
That's thing. Correct. They do structure it differently, but some employers make the mistake of doing something like this. You work 60 hours 1 week as a non-exempt employee, and then the next week I say, oh, just come in, you know, for 20 hours. You're actually entitled to 20 hours of overtime in the work in which you, you know, the week in which you worked it. I can flex within the work week. So if you're my assistant and you have worked 40 hours by Thursday, I can say, hey, Jane, take Friday off. Mm-hmm. That's okay. Mm-hmm. That's flexing within the same work week. But so mistakes are made by employers just because they're looking at this very simply. And I guess what I'm saying to you is that as employers sit down and say, if I can't afford the overtime, because you should do budgeting, do some projections. If I don't think I can afford that, let's look at how I might be able to spread some of this work out. Maybe what it means is I hire other people. One of the impacts that the Federal Department of Labor has talked about and that various think tanks have talked about is that there may be more employment. You may have more people becoming employed. Some individuals will say, oh, well, those are just low-paying jobs. Maybe not. Maybe they're good office jobs and good jobs that might have been considered quote-unquote white-collar before, but now there may be more of them because maybe I'm splitting the job between two individuals. Another one of the things that it allows people to do is maybe think about work-life balance a little bit differently. And I think that when you think about efficiencies, and if you're a great employee and you say, I don't mind working through my lunch or I don't mind taking work home, that may be great for you as a person who has a lot of get up and go. But by the same token, as an employer, maybe what I want to do is say to you, I totally appreciate that motivation, but let's look at that in terms of greater efficiencies. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about getting your motivation and maybe the motivation of another coworker. How can we do things a little bit more efficiently so that we can all go home on Friday afternoon when it's really sunny out?
So what if I'm a worker who makes about $45,000 right yep. now, and I am going to fall into this category of somebody who will now be eligible for overtime pay? My employer could say, we're going to bump you up to $47,000, $477 a year, which would take me over the threshold by a dollar, right? And so now I'm no longer eligible for overtime pay, right?
So as long as you're performing exempt duties, yes.
Okay.
So remember, salary and duties test. So if you are currently performing appropriate exempt duties to be either executive, administrative, professional, computer exempt, highly compensated employee, if you are fitting those any of those standards on the duties test side and they bump you up above the salary test, yes, you become then non-eligible for overtime.
Okay. So that's one possibility for employers who are saying, I don't know how much this would cost me in overtime, but I know I can probably afford a couple thousand dollars to bump up somebody's salary.
Sure.
An employer could also say, well, you know, it turns out I think you're actually working more like 50 or 60 hours a week, but we're not paying you, so now we'll have to pay you the overtime. But here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to lower your salary to $35,000 a year. But don't worry, you'll probably make about the same amount because once we factor in overtime, you'll be making that time and a half. That's also totally legal. An employer could reduce salaries to cover what they now are going to anticipate they're paying in overtime expenses.
That would be legal, yes.
Do you anticipate companies will do that? I mean, I can't imagine employees are going to like that, but they may not have much of a choice.
So they may not like it. And again, I think it's I heard a commentator the other day say something like, so what we're going to do is we're going to demote all these people down to hourly workers and we're going to cut their pay. You know, if that's how you sell it, yeah, absolutely. Your workforce will be unhappy. But another way to do it is to say, here's my full budget. Here's what I spend on each of these positions over the course of time. And folks, I know you work hard. I know you work long hours. I want to be able to afford that because I know you work hard. I don't want to give you a disincentive to work that. But in order to be able to afford your extra effort, I got to move the hourly wage down. But if you work the same number of hours that you're going to, you're not going to have a net loss. And in fact, you have the potential for a net gain because if you work more than that, you know, I may have to pay you more than that. That's a possibility. So I would agree with you. There's always two ways to look at these kinds of situations. I have a tendency to look at it as an opportunity rather than a loss. So.
And you mentioned employers could also just take many of their salaried workers and make them hourly.
That's true.
So you could sort of imagine, you know, I think this is about what your hourly wages are, and now we're going to codify that. Now you are an hourly worker. Because it's easier to do than trying to have somebody on salary, but then also calculate, you know, when they're coming and going.
Well, again, remember that just because somebody is salaried doesn't mean that I'm not thinking about overtime. So, for instance, you know, the people who are, you know, legal assistants where I work, they are non-exempt employees based on the functionality they do. They don't hit the duties test. But, you know, we are careful. They're professionals. They are people that we are highly skilled, a lot of them long tenure, but we do track time because we have to. And, you know, it's not that hard to do, actually.
You'd probably be in trouble if you weren't keeping track of these laws, if you weren't paying attention to which of your employees were exempt or non-exempt.
I think that would be an issue, sure, if I didn't do that right.
But there must be, I mean, you said this is a really employee-friendly federal law
that's
already in place or federal regulation. But there must be tons of employers who haven't been tracking time that carefully or haven't – maybe certainly not maliciously, but haven't been doing it quite right.
Sure.
So is it not enforced very well?
I wouldn't say that. We've got some terrific investigators here in Vermont with the Department of Labor, Federal Department of Labor, with whom I work pretty regularly, who do this on a pretty regular basis. And I would say it's very common for record-keeping violations for employers. And again, it's not for any purpose in easily 9.5 out of 10 situations. It's just, oh, I didn't know that. You know, oh, I didn't realize that. Or the common misconception of, oh, well, this person is salaried, so I didn't think I had to pay them overtime. So because this law is so old and because the regulations haven't changed significantly over the course of time, this is a good opportunity for re-education and for rethinking maybe some of the positions that you have. And I do think, just from the work that I do with many employers, I do think that we as Americans have spread out our work like water in a pan. You know, if you have a pan that's short but, you know, wide, your work is going to spread out that way. If you give somebody a small amount of, you know, a pan, it may go deep. So it's I think it's basically how we've been looking at it for a while is that, it's all these hours. I have to work them. that may not be the best way to do it. And part of that is actually managing employees, actually knowing what they're doing, how efficient they're being. We've been on autopilot, I think, for a while. And you see that in many employers as you talk to them about these issues. And they say, well, it's always been that way. Well, maybe this is an opportunity for us to rethink.
All right. Well, I'd love to know, listeners, what you're thinking. We're going to take your calls and emails coming up. Do you see a change in work-life balance coming along with these regulations? There have been some worries as well out there that people fear that their employers will have less of an ability to work with flexible schedules, work with, you know, a few hours here, a few hours at night. You know, are you worried about changes in what your employer might do to try to make sure that your employer is staying right on the straight and narrow with this law? And employers, I'd love to know what you're thinking. How do you figure out what to do with this mandatory change? Do you know how many employees in your company are affected by this and what you'll do? Are you worried about overtime that's a little bit trickier to calculate or to anticipate in your payroll than an hourly wage that's set might be? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Coming up, we'll have Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Labor, Annie Noonan, on the show. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Karen Stackpole leads the Employment and Labor Law Group at Paul Frank and Collins Attorneys. We're talking with her today about how the new federal regulations around overtime pay for salaried workers are likely to affect Vermonters. State government says maybe 10,000 Vermonters could be eligible for overtime, but it's not clear how employers could change policies to both comply with the law and minimize the disruption this change could cause. If you're a salaried worker and you make under $47,500 or so dollars a year, have you thought about what this might mean for you? Have you talked to your employer about it? Has a policy memo gone out? Employers, are you going to have to change the way you keep track of how much your employees are working? Call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or tweet us at Vermont Edition. Here to tell us a little bit more about how the state is looking at this is Annie Noonan, Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Labor. Commissioner, it's nice to have you back on the show.
Oh, thanks very much.
From the state's perspective, is this federal regulation, federal rule change a good thing?
Yeah, I think that what we're looking at is being clear. I heard Karen Stackpole speaking earlier, and I think she's absolutely right. It's just making sure that people, we think that there's two benefits. One is that there is some clearer guidance, I think, to the employer community about this, and it is not just the salary basis test. Moving that salary up, it hasn't been moved up since 2004, but also taking a look at the standard duties test. And I think that it's time for employers to kind of assess to make sure that they're doing it correctly, because what nobody really wants to see happen is somebody who thinks they're doing the right thing get caught up in an audit and wind up with lots and lots of back pay and penalties. So there's that piece of it, asking employers to kind of do a more current assessment of where they're at. And the second thing is ensuring that people who are are really able to move forward in if they're working lots and lots of overtime, if they're really entitled to be paid overtime, we think that that's an important thing, that people are treated fairly in the workplace. And again, the rate at $23,000 and some odd dollars a year had not been updated for many, many years, and now it goes to a higher level, and I think that won't change. Again, it doesn't change people's hourly rate, but it does in fact ensure that people get paid overtime once they hit that 40-hour mark.
Do you have a sense of who this is most likely to affect in Vermont? What sectors and what workers?
Yeah, we did some preliminary analysis as the federal law was passing. We think here in Vermont it will primarily affect retail sales, food services, merchandise, and places like and sales and purchasing, some construction. And probably the tourism and hospitality, where you have lodging managers and even in medical and health science managers. So you've got people in terms of medical coding and those kinds of services at the hospitals. So we think the U.S. Department of Labor had estimated 10,000. When we first did an analysis, we thought it was about 8,500, but we only looked at sort of some key industries. So bringing in those other areas that could be impacted, we think about 10,000 workers in Vermont is about correct. So we do agree that the USDOL's number is probably accurate.
We got a question from Wes in Facedon who wonders how this will affect seasonal workers. Do you know, Commissioner Noonan?
Well, seasonal workers are not exempt under FLSA currently. So, it's always the duties test. You know, so the duties test really deals with whether you're exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act because of being a professional employee or a highly compensated employee or an administrative or executive employee. So seasonal employees right now, for the most part in Vermont, unless there's some very special exemption under the law, are already covered under FLSA, and so they are probably now being paid. I would suspect that most of them are already being paid time and a half once it hits a 40-hour work week.
Are you seeing any downsides for the state? I mean, there have been concerns about will employers have to lay people off or pay them less, or you know, there are some concerns about how this might play out. Are you seeing any?
Well, I think that there are probably some situations where employers right now will have to do better record keeping, and they'll have to do more accurate record keeping. I know that an employer wrote to me and said, you know, right now I let people take time off during the day, and we're really not keeping track of that. It's much more of an honor system. I think the employee is covered by FLSA, but we just let people kind of come and go. And the answer is you can still allow that flexibility. If you still want somebody to be able to take time off to go up to, a child addressing, you know, something at school for their kids or something like that, you can still do that. You just need to make sure that, you know, at some point you know whether that employee has worked 40 hours a week or that week or not. We have heard that some people have said, well, you know, I'll adjust the salary to capture the hours over 40 and then convert it to some sort of an hourly pay rate. I don't know that we think that will happen in Vermont with a 3.2% unemployment rate and employers, you know, in many cases really clamoring for workers. And I really don't think that most Vermont employers are going to want to do anything that takes sort of some of their more tenured or senior or trusted employees and do anything to kind of create dissension by adjusting salaries downwards in a scheme such as that. So I think that I don't think we anticipate that happening. We're doing research right now to take a look at whether or not there was any type of drop-off in 2004 when the federal government raised the rates back then, under the same scenario. We were looking at the USDOL numbers and trying to see if we saw any change here in Vermont. We don't have that data yet. But, you know, sometimes we hear the same thing with the minimum wage increase. You know, every time the minimum wage goes up, you have some folks that say, well, you know, I'm going to have to start laying people off. And the evidence in Vermont is not there to show that happens. And I think Karen Stackpole pointed out that there are ways that we think employers might adjust to this. They might move people who are close to that rate, that $947,913 a week. We might see people just raise the salary to keep the employee under exempt, provided that they still meet the duties test. Or some folks will pay overtime, and they'll be budgeting for that at this point. Or they'll realign duties in a way to make sure that the work is spread out differently, so that people don't work over 40. And that, again, does address issues such as giving people time off. You know, less time at work is more work-life balance, and I think that has a value in to employees and even to the employer. I think a good balance of people having time off and with their families and doing what they need to do personally is also good. But again, we will take a look to see. We will track this carefully to see if we see any changes in pay or changes in the total number of workforce in Vermont.
Annie Noonan is Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Labor. Commissioner Noonan, thank you for talking to us about what the state's seeing and what you're looking at. We'll be interested to hear what you find in terms of what happened in 2004, the last time changes were made to this regulation. Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome. Have a good day. Bye.
And again, if you are affected by this law, think you might be, are concerned, worried, excited, maybe that idea of work-life balance being really codified is something that appeals to you, that hasn't been available to you, or you haven't felt like it's been available to you in your job up to now. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And let's go right to a call from Chris in Winooski. Hi, Chris. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. You guys have addressed this. You've touched on it a little bit throughout the conversation. As an employee, a salaried employee that makes about $35,000 a year, approximately, I'm just wondering, I've been wondering this for years, how, you know, I regularly work 60 to 80 hours a week just due to the nature of the job. And I can only basically take days off when I ignore the email or ignore the phone. And how do you address this with an employer? Like, how is this going to be verified? And I'm certainly glad that it's becoming a law soon, but how do you go about assimilating it to the workplace? How's the transition going to work, and how can we hold the employer accountable for this kind of thing, as well as tracking hours? It's kind of a vague question, but I just don't know how the employer is going to be held accountable for this kind of thing, and who would be the person doing that? How do we address that with the employer? Because, I mean, if we ignore the clientele and don't do the job, then the job doesn't get done, and it's certainly not going to get done in my case with 40 hours a week or less than that.
So, Chris, I want Karen Stackpole to address your questions, but let me ask you right now, are you comfortable working 60, 80 hours a week, and does your employer know it?
The employer is aware, and it tends to come and go. We have busier times of year than others, and it's really a college-based kind of scenario. However, you know, the work doesn't stop coming in. It's basically you get it done, because I have to work. I have to do homework constantly and also be on site at the job over 40 hours a week, yeah, every week on site in addition to homework. So I'm kind of excited about the new law, but concerned that the employer isn't going to be held accountable or possibly ignore the fact that, you know, we're going way over 40 hours a week every week.
Yeah, Chris, let's put your question to Karen Stackpole, because, you know, here's Chris, who is an actual person working 60 to 80 hours a week with his employer's knowledge, is salaried worker. And under these changes, you know, it sounds like Chris would be eligible for massive amounts of overtime if he's tracking his time correctly and his employer is saying, well, you got to do, you know, whatever it takes to get the job done. Or, you know what, yeah, how does this all work out? And who's responsible? Who keeps the employer in line?
Sure. And actually, nothing about these this new federal rule changes the lines of accountability. So as I mentioned, the burden of proof on these laws, both state and federal, is really on the employer to make sure, A, they're tracking the time right, B, that they are paying employees appropriately. And the exemptions under the Vermont statute pretty much track the federal, because it's written into the Vermont statute that anybody who's a bona fide executive, administrative, professional exempt, that sort of thing. So they basically track one another. In each state and federal statute, too, there is accountability through two basic means. One is to contact an administrative agency, like in Vermont, the Department of Labor. So Commissioner Noonan's department does accept complaints, and they do investigate them, and they do audits. And if they find that somebody is not being paid enough, they will work with the employer to make sure that that changes and get back pay for the employee. On the federal level, It happens through the Federal Department of Labor. And again, complaint process is the same. So whether you contact the Vermont Department of Labor or the Federal Department of Labor, you have those opportunities already under each federal and state statute. The other thing is there's actually a private right of action under each of these statutes. Private right of action, and what I tell employers all the time is this is a law you want to get right because the damages and the danger to you is significant. So a private right of action, a person who thinks they're inappropriately paid, if they have been tracking their time and they will swear under oath, this is what I've been working, and hopefully they have evidence of that, they have the right to bring that to suit and the in either state or federal court. And the employer then it bears the burden to show that they've been paying them accurately. So that accountability is already there. In terms of talking to the employer, I would just go in to the employer, sit down in a non-accusatory way and just say, hey, I've noticed that there's a change here. Gee, what is this going to do to my job? This is basically how much I work. I've been taking a look at that for the last couple of weeks and really tracking it. This is kind of the history. I know this is what you're paying me. If I go to, you know, a non-exempt status, that's going to be, you know, X amount more. How shall we work on this together and make sure either we've got the right budget for that or we look at my duties and we look at something. I would take a proactive but positive approach to the employer. And if the employer is smart, they will take you up on that conversation and do it in a good way.
So an employer, I mean, legally can't, but also shouldn't think they're going to be able to get away with saying, Karen, your job should only take you 40 hours a week, and I don't want to pay you overtime. So I'm going to assume you can get this done in 40 hours. And if you can't, you know, that's your problem, not mine.
Yeah, that would be illegal. So the bottom line is the standard is if I know or should have known that you were doing something for my benefit. So the rule under the federal law is suffered or permitted to work. So I either require you to work that overtime or I permit it. I see you working through your lunch. I know that you're taking massive volumes of things home because you're sending me all those emails. Now, that's not de minimis stuff. So, yes, occasionally people are going to check their email. Does that mean you're entitled to 10 hours of overtime for being there? Absolutely not. But if you are legitimately coming in early, staying late, really doing things for the benefit of your employer, and the employer is aware of that, you are entitled to overtime for that. However, I can discipline you too. I can, as an employer, say, hey, I appreciate that, but I only have X amount of budget for overtime. So let's sit down and look at your job. Why is this taking you 10 hours each day when maybe if we shift them things around, you can get it all done in 8? So a smart employer is, again, going to look at those efficiencies because it would be an absolute mistake to say, you should get this done in 8 hours. I'm not paying you for more than 8. If the person is truly not exempt, that's a violation of the law. Pretty easy one. So be smarter than that, employers, because I know you are. And be looking at, efficiencies and work with your employees to get it done, you know, appropriately in the amount of time it's necessary.
Maybe we can have you on and see how things are going a year or so into this law. See how that works.
Yeah. Exactly.
Karen Stackpole leads the Employment and Labor Law Group at Paul Frank and Collins Attorneys. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, why is there so much extra cheese being produced right now? I mean, real cheese, you know, the kind that you eat. We'll talk agricultural economics and why it's always tied right back to milk prices next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, the Wall Street Journal had an alarming suggestion. There's currently such a surplus of cheese in this country that every American would need to, quote, eat an extra 3 pounds this year to work it off. That is, by the way, on top of the 36 pounds of cheese the average American already consumes each year. Now, for some of us, adding even more delicious cheese to our diet is a sacrifice we would be willing to make for the country. But as those in the Vermont dairy industry know, this is really all about the economics of milk prices. Joining us now to explain is Bob Parsons, professor of community development and applied economics at UVM Extension. Bob, nice to talk with you again.
Okay, thank you.
Can we just pause for a moment on that 36 pound of cheese the average American eats figure? I mean, that's a lot of cheese we're already eating in this country, isn't it?
Well, it's a lot of cheese, but what we have to realize is that we have more milk going into cheese now than what we have going into fluid milk. So cheese is the primary driver of the milk price at the farm level.
Okay. All right. So it sounded like or could have been inferred from the tone of this Wall Street Journal article that people were alarmed, reporters were alarmed to discover that there's more cheese than normal. But I take it you're not surprised that we have this amount of cheese going up and up.
We've got a surplus of milk right now in the United States. As little as a year and a half ago, we were exporting maybe about 17% of our annual production. That has dropped now for various reasons to under like about 12%. So along with that, dairy farmers just keep producing more milk, and we've got more milk on the market than what we can consume in this country. And so we're very dependent upon international trade conditions, you know, the value of the dollar and consumption in countries like China and other Pacific Rim countries that affects our farm milk price.
And right now, I mean, for a while, it seemed like the consumption of milk in China was on the rise and American dairy producers were seeing a benefit from that. Is that not happening anymore?
Well, it's dropped a little bit, but China, you know, they're like any other good bargainer. If we can buy milk, dairy products cheaper from Australia and New Zealand, why buy from America? And right now, the Australian dollar and New Zealand dollar are considerably lower. So that gives their dairy products a cheap, you know, makes them cheaper on the international market than what American products are.
All right. So the equation can get very complicated, but to simplify it here, you know, maybe you can help explain when dairy prices are low, typically milk producers don't make less milk because they still need to make a profit. So there's often more milk going into the system. And of course, fluid milk can't last indefinitely. So if you're putting more milk in the system and somebody's trying to make some money off of it, it often goes into a product that can be put on the shelf or put in storage for a while. So it's powdered milk or cheese. Is that why we're seeing so much cheese?
Essentially, you've got fluid milk. I mean, within a, you know, there are federal laws that within so many hours after that milk is picked up, it has to be headed and done something for processing. It's a huge medium for bacterial growth. And we have milk that goes for fluid milk, and that's what people most likely associate it with it. But you also think of, yogurt, cottage cheese, ice cream, hard cheeses, as well as powdered milk, as well as butter. So milk goes into a gambit of activities or products, and the three that are the easiest to store are butter, powdered milk, and cheese.
So that would explain why we're seeing more cheese if milk prices have been low.
Yes, if you've got too much milk, you don't have it for international markets, you do something with the milk, and it's most easier to make it in the cheese, and you know, then you also depend on what the butter markets are, of whether you need to ship into more butter, or you try to put in the powdered milk. And then you might have a surplus of powdered milk on the market, and so you end up shifting it to where you can use it for that most storable product.
So, you know, there used to be this expression or this phrase that people may remember, government cheese. Is it the government still that's taking the, you know, the federal government taking that surplus milk?
And no,
since 2012,
has gotten out of the business of buying and storing agricultural products. They have programs to help maybe export some dairy products, but right now this is this is all in the private sector here right now, and so basically you don't have the government piling up quantities of cheese that you would think about whenever you're old enough to remember back to the 1980s when the government decided to give away because it was costing too much to store. But the government is out of the storage business now, so we've got we've got a downturn in consumption of dairy products for U.S. dairy products because we've lost some of our, you know, international markets. We also have the European Union, which has discontinued their quota, and that has resulted in increased milk production. And then you have Russia that, due to international reasons over Ukraine and stuff, has discontinued importation of agricultural products from Western Europe, is not buying many dairy products, so that is dumped on the international market. So what you have right now is between the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, and the European Union, we just have a lot of extra milk on the market.
So how is this affecting Vermont producers, dairy producers, quite specifically? Because we not only have dairy producers, but what about our cheese market, too? Because we typically think of cheese in Vermont. There's a high degree of artisan cheesemakers here who are not necessarily making a block of cheddar that can be stored in the freezer for 3 years.
Well, artisan cheese is a very, very small sliver of the market. basically, what is really happening right now is with our conventional dairy farmers, they are back to prices that we haven't seen since 2009, and 2009 was a disaster. And basically, most of the farmers right now, they're seeing prices that are probably maybe $4 or $5 under their cost of production. And so they're tightening the belt and cutting back spending where they can. And if you talk to farm suppliers, bills are starting to accumulate, feed bills, supply bills, fuel bills, any other bills associated with the farm. And so right now, the process is the dairy farmers are pulling their belts tighter and trying to make through this until they see a return of some higher milk prices. And that could come with a change in international conditions. If Russia gets better on terms with Western Europe and the West and reopens their markets to Western agricultural products, that can be a big help, and maybe a rejuvenation, a little bit of a market, and maybe even a lowering of the U.S. dollar, a combination of those could end up raising the milk price for the American farmers. And one of the things that has happened right now is whenever the milk price is down, the farmers, an individual farmer knows that if we just reduce milk supply, we would lower the milk supply and raise milk price. But for an individual, a separate dairy farmer, he's only faced with one choice, and that is, I need more money to pay my bills, and if I can produce more milk, I'll get more money.
Bob Parsons is a professor of community development and applied economics at UVM Extension. Thanks so much for talking a little bit about dairy economics and the cheese glut we're seeing in this country. Bob, I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Tomorrow is a momentous anniversary. 15 years ago to the day, Senator Jim Jeffords rocked Washington by leaving the Republican Party and becoming an independent. On Vermont Edition, we'll look back at how and when Jeffords made that decision and what effect it had on the U.S. government. Send your recollections of that time or your questions about when Jeffords defected to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen to the show tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.